Psalm 90 says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting you are God. You return man to dust and say, return, O children of man. For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? So teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. Let your work be shown to your servants, and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Right. Thank you, God in heaven, that your wrath has been appeased. That we here now stand before you because of the blood of Christ, and we can give praise and honor to you. In Jesus' name. Okay, we're going to be now continuing forward in Genesis to chapter 41. We learned last week about Joseph's interpretation of the prisoner's dreams, the cupbearer and the baker. Joseph interpreted them, and what he said had come to pass. Chapter 41 begins 2 years later, it says, with Pharaoh having a dream. And it tells us what the dream was. It says in verse 2, it says, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile, and behold, there came up out of the Nile 7 cows. Attractive and plump, and they fed in the reed grass. And behold, 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly, thin, plump cows, And the ugly, thin, plump cows ate up the 7 attractive plump... And the ugly thin cows ate up the 7 attractive plump cows. And Pharaoh awoke. And he fell asleep and dreamed a second time. And behold, 7 ears of grain, plump and good, were growing on 1 stalk. And behold, after them sprouted 7 ears, thin and blighted, by the east wind. And the thin ears swallowed up the plump, 7 plump full ears. And Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. So in the morning his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all of his wise men. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Okay, so 2 years later, after the interpretation of the cupbearer and baker's dreams, Pharaoh has a dream. The dream, there's actually two dreams, the dreams back to back. He wakes up between the dreams and goes back to sleep to get the second, has the second dream. And in the morning, his spirit is troubled. Now, this word spirit is the same spirit we read in Genesis, and the spirit hovers over the waters. And later on, literally means breath. And in the context, interpretively, a lot of times it means the life, with the life within. So this gives indication that Pharaoh's troubling was not superficial. It was a deep troubling. He was troubled deeply. He wanted to know what the dreams meant. He didn't just wake up and think, huh, I had a dream. That was a weird dream, and go about his life. He was dwelling on these dreams. He was saying, these dreams are significant, and I want to know what they mean. So, he calls for all the magicians of Egypt and his wise men. And this is where I kind of got the idea last week that likely there were, for the people of Egypt in their system of worship, there were people available who would interpret dreams, magicians / wise men available. Could be that it was only Pharaoh that had access to these men, but I doubt it. But it doesn't say it. But we do know that Pharaoh has access to these men. They're called, the English word used here is magicians. This word in Hebrew literally means engravers. Engravers, drawers of lines. And the contextual representation of that are those who form horoscopes. A lot of times, if you're familiar with astrology at all, not astronomy, but astrology, people who think they can look in the heavens and tell you your futures by the stars and where they line up, etc. So this is the idea of these magicians. And then later it says, and wise men. The word is very simple here. It simply means people with wisdom. So this would also be something like counselors. So Pharaoh certainly had counselors that he would go to, you know, to help him make decisions. So he brings in, basically he brings in those whom he thinks can answer the question. Those who he either believes from their wisdom or from their potential connection with the spiritual world might be able to give him an answer to what his dreams meant. So, as we read about this, see, this is similar to what we read about with Nebuchadnezzar. When Nebuchadnezzar has his dreams, it's not exactly the same. There's actually several differences here. One of the differences I want to point out, too, is that this is not the same word that is used in Daniel for the magicians that Nebuchadnezzar goes to try to ask about his dreams. It's a different word. Now, functionally, it seems like they probably have some very similar responsibilities and presumed and probably like actual capabilities to interpret stuff. Whether that came from, what sources does it say? Interestingly, if you contrast the two, Nebuchadnezzar didn't even, Pharaoh actually tells this guy, he's like, this is what I dreamed, what's it mean? Nebuchadnezzar, he's like, no, if you really know what it's going to mean, you're going to tell me what I dreamed and tell me what it means. That way I know you know. Which was, it's just kind of interesting. But nevertheless, Pharaoh tells them his dreams, and it says they could not interpret them. Now, I found it interesting that it used the word could and not just were not able to. It's more than, it seems like it's more than not just being able to. But they literally could not tell him. So, just as you think of human nature, these were men just like any other men. You would think, hey, they serve the king. He says, hey, what do my dreams mean? They would want to try to tell him something, right? Maybe even just give him some suggestions. But it was almost like they could not even say anything. They just really couldn't think of anything to say, which is I find quite interesting and maybe even divinely orchestrated. There's nothing specific about that. I find it quite interesting that they had nothing to say, not even a guess. But it says here, quite frankly, that they could not interpret the dreams for him. So Pharaoh is left without getting what he wants. He does not have his answers. And so he presumably remains deeply troubled about this. He's deeply troubled to start with. He still has no answers. Maybe he's even more troubled now. Oh my goodness, if my wise men, if my magicians can't tell me, what's the deal, right? It's at this point where the chief cupbearer comes back into our story. Verse 9. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, I remember my offenses today, when Pharaoh was angry with his servant and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard. We dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with his own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. We told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted to us, so it came about. I was restored to my office, and the baker was hanged. So here we are. Pharaoh apparently is discussing this, and the cupbearer somehow or another hears about it. Maybe he's there. Maybe somebody tells him or whatever. But at this point, the chief cupbearer speaks to Pharaoh. And he has this phrase, I remember my offenses today. There's different ideas about what he means by this. When you consider the immediate context, it appears to the really what he's saying is I remember the time when I angered Pharaoh. I remember this time I angered Pharaoh, and then I got put in jail, and then I met this Hebrew guy. So that he remembers that Pharaoh's dreams make him remember his dreams, and they occurred back when he made Pharaoh mad. So he's talking to Pharaoh, and it's kind of like, it'd be like if you were talking to somebody that, you know, you had offended, and you'd gone through this situation with, and you go, hey, I remember when I messed up, kind of thing. So I'm just sort of put that some phraseology. Now, there are, just so you know, there are about, according to my research, about a third of commentators, they interpret this to mean that the chief cupbearer is talking about an offense to Joseph. It is out there, but if you consider just the text in the immediate context, it's more, I think it's more appropriate that he's talking about his offenses to Pharaoh here. So when he does this, it's interesting also that he includes the baker in his story and that they both had dreams and they both had them on the same night. And then when he speaks of Joseph, he calls him the young Hebrew. This young Hebrew, basically this young Hebrew slave. Because the word servant there is the same as, I mean, it means the same thing as slave. And so, and then the fourth point he makes is that the interpretations that he received came true. And I think it's really, I think that probably included, I mean, included the, I don't know why he included the baker ultimately, but to me, including the baker in his story was significant because not only was it just one dream that got interpreted correctly, but two. And Pharaoh would know what happened to the baker, too. So I think that's all went together to give Pharaoh this really strong impression. This guy may not know what he's talking about. He was impressed by it. So, and So I think I'll leave it at that. So the cupbearer tells him this, and then it says, then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph. It gives you the impression that it was like right then, like, hey, go get this dude. It's not necessarily has to be that way, but it certainly has that impression. So Pharaoh sends for Joseph, and then we're dead. So then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. So I'll stop there for a minute. So Pharaoh calls for Joseph, and quickly being brought, again, I think this points back to his deep troubledness of this whole situation. And it, you know, when it, that impression that they just immediately went to go get him is you know, seems pretty reasonable here. They brought him out of the pit. That same word could mean the dungeon. It's referring to that the prison where he's being held there. And interesting that they shaved him and changed his clothes. Obviously, not obviously, but I shouldn't say obviously because not everybody realizes. Back in that day, prisons weren't what they are today. They're very dirty, stinky, bad places. Much less concern for the prisoners. They really could mostly kind of care less where they lived or died in the prisons. So, bad place to be. I've heard it said, I don't know if this is true, that the culture of Egypt was to be clean shaven and such, maybe, and that they even maybe shaved their heads. So maybe they wanted to be in Pharaoh's presence. Maybe that's why they shaved him. I don't have a clue if that's really true or not. But they cleaned him up, and it's very interesting that they specifically mentioned that they shaved him. So he's now in front of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh wants to say, "Hey, I've heard it say you can interpret these dreams." So now we get Joseph's response to this from Pharaoh. Verse 16 says, "Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." All right. I want to focus on this for a minute here. This, I'm reading out of the ESV, but I don't really quite like it very much here. I don't like the way that you, I don't like the word favorable for this interpretation. I'm going to give you some other options. A very literal word for word would be, and Joseph answered Pharaoh saying, apart from me, God will answer for the peace / welfare of Pharaoh. That's an interpretation of that verse from the Hebrew. In the Septuagint, it reads, and Joseph answered Pharaoh and said, without God, the salvation / safety, I say / those are just two different ways you could say that particular word. You can sort of pick and they're just to give more understanding and context and fill out the word. Without God, the salvation or safety of Pharaoh will not be answered. Thought that was an interesting twist to it. In the NET, it says, Joseph replied to Pharaoh, it is not within my power, but God will speak concerning the welfare of Pharaoh. Couple other potentials is, I can't interpret the dreams, but God can and will give Pharaoh peace of mind regarding the dreams. Or, I can't interpret the dreams, says Joseph, but God can and will tell Pharaoh, will tell of the welfare of Pharaoh. Basically, will tell what's going to happen to Pharaoh. What is going to be the results of the future for Pharaoh. And I think all of these basically are saying something very close to the same thing, but they kind of build the richness of what he's saying to Pharaoh. And that's one of the things I don't like. The way it reads in the ESV, it sounds like God's going to give him the reply he wants, the favorable reply. That's to me what I hear when I hear favorable. I don't think that's what Joseph was saying. I don't think he was promising Pharaoh that what I'm going to tell you, God says, is like, you're going to like it. I don't think that's what he was saying. So to me, I steer toward these other situations here. Nevertheless, Joseph speaks very humbly here. We're going to talk about Joseph and his humility a little bit later, but Joseph speaks humbly. He points out that it's not he that will be able to interpret these dreams by himself and his own power. It is through God. This is a good place to also I want to make a quick point in terms of the wording for God throughout this section. Where everybody's aware, the Hebrew word is Elohim when it's not in all caps, right? So sometimes you'll see L-O-R-D in all caps. That's when they use the Hebrew word Yahweh. Or if you see God in all caps, G-O-D in all caps, that's always, you can always know, you don't even have to look, that's going to be Yahweh in the Hebrew. Here, God is Elohim, and I think it's here. Hang on just a second. Let me double check before I tell you. I don't want to tell you the wrong thing. Yes, this is in this chapter when it says God, lower just like capital G-O-D, without the all caps. Every time it's going to be Elohim is the Hebrew word. And here is the only place it's just the word Elohim and not without the prefix ha, H-A. Ha means the in Hebrew. So if you look into it and you say ha Elohim, it means the God or the gods. And it all depends on the context and the verb that's modifying the noun God. So I did check them all, and then there's only one time, and it's later when Pharaoh's talking, that the verb form is not actually clear whether it's plural or singular. Every other time, it's a singular verb. That means that it's being used as the God, a singular God. So here, Joseph is using it, and it's in it. See, when he says, God will give an answer. Answer, to answer is your verb, and it's plural. I mean, it's singular. So God here giving an answer is a singular God giving an answer. Otherwise, they would have used the plural form of answer, and it would have, like, if I said, what's tomorrow, and everybody in here answered Monday, I would have to use the plural form of answer because I got more than one person answering me. I was telling somebody, yeah, they answered me Monday. That's, I would be saying it in plural, using they, and even though the same word answer can be, we don't have a plural form of that word, you know. Does that make any sense to everybody? Okay. So just to make sure we're all on the same page again about this, in this case, what's going on. So Joseph answers Pharaoh, I can't interpret your dreams, but God can, and will give Pharaoh either peace of mind regarding them, or he's going to tell Pharaoh about what's going to happen with the welfare of Pharaoh. So I think either one of those, both of those get accomplished through what happens. All right. Now, where am I? Okay. Distracted there. Point 17. I'm on the wrong page. Okay. 17 through 24, Pharaoh is basically recounting his dreams again. And it's almost word for word, if not word for word. I didn't double check exactly word for word, but I read through it. There's no real differences to really talk about. It's the same story again. He recounts the dreams exactly the way it's recounted the first time. So, interesting thing. So then Joseph says to Pharaoh, verse 25, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one. The seven lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty ears blighted by the east wind are also 7 years of famine. I think that's... I don't keep going. It is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Okay, right there. That has shown, that's a verb, and it's singular. So he's saying, ha, and this would also be ha, Elohim. It would be it would be appropriate to, in English to put it, it is as I told Pharaoh, the God, like the one God, the singular God, has shown to Pharaoh what he's about to do. So, important points here. Joseph says both dreams are one. They mean the same thing. Okay? It's not two different dreams telling you two different things. It's one dream. The two of them together are one dream telling you the same thing. And he says this God, the God, telling you what not is going to happen, but what he's about to do. This is a great verse to go to for God's sovereignty. This is not just, hey, God told me what's going to happen. He knows all the fates that are out there that could happen, and he knows which one is just going to happen. No, he's saying God is telling you what he's going to do. He's in control of this, which is why God can tell me what the dreams mean, because he's the one who gave the dreams. Another point here is very important here, I think, is that it says, it doesn't actually, let's see here. Okay, it doesn't say this, but when it says God has shown you what he's going to do, this is basically telling Pharaoh, God has spoken to you. He spoke not with words and audibleness, like he remembered what he heard. He remembers what he saw in his dream, right? But this is God speaking to Pharaoh because he wants Pharaoh to know what's going to happen. So God is speaking to Pharaoh, which I think would have probably impressed Pharaoh that God would be willing and he spoke to him. And God speaks to us as well. And so that's important. Now, verse 26. Let's see. I already read that. Verse 29. I mean. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, there will arise 7 years of famine. And all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of famine that will follow it, for it will be very severe. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dreams means that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. Okay, so 7 years of what? 7 years of great plenty. That's what that's what's represented by the cows being fat. Because cows that are fat have consumed excessive feed. Okay? Like a normal cow, you put them out on grass, and they just graze in grass, got a nice clean water to drink out of, and so they can stay healthy and they have grass. They can get by on that, that's all they need, but they're not going to be fat. That Angus steak you bought at the store, it's got all the nice marbling in it. You don't get that from a normal cow out on the normal grass. You have to feed them extra. You have to give them more than their body needs, because when you get more than your body needs, it stores it as fat. So the fact that these cows were fat and plump indicates they're beyond just regular old cows. These 7 years weren't just normal 7 years. They were like excessive abundant 7 years. That's what we get from this great plenty and from the description of the cows. Okay? Now, and then the contrast is exactly that. I mean, it's, you know, the seven skinny cows, they're gaunt, it says in some versions. So they're not getting enough. They don't even have the normal amount, okay? Maybe they have nothing. So they're going to burn all their fat up to try to survive. They're going to start breaking down their muscles and burning their muscles to survive. eventually they're going to run out of everything, and everything's going to stop. They're going to die. So that's what they are. And they consume the seven fat cows and the seven plump ears. They consume them, and they're gone. They consume them to the point that verse 31. Hang on a second. I had a point to make here. No, verse 30. But after them, there will rise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. Consumed to the point that they won't even remember the good years. Not even the good. These weren't normal good years. These were excessively good years. In a minute, I'm going to give you how excessively good these years had to be, or a calculation of sorts. They were so good they were forgotten. And this is the same word that we've heard about when the cupbearer forgot Joseph. They were forgotten. They were completely forgotten. Okay? Now, so how good were they? All right. We're going to read in a little bit. I'm going to go ahead and spoiler. Joseph is going to tell Pharaoh that the thing to do is to save 1/5 of the grain that's going to be produced. Right? Everybody kind of knows the story here. 1/5 of the grain. Well, you can figure out how good those good years were for 1/5 of that grain to last for 7 years after that. If you do the math, that's 20%. 1/5 is 20%. And if you do the math, the good years, the seven of plenty, had to be 5 times as productive of a normal year for those 7 years that follow for there to be enough for them to be normal. Now, that's the easy calculation, is to say, you know, that if the famine years go to zero, how much needed was that 20%? I mean, how much did that 20% need? What was 20% of how much was that to bump them back up to a normal year? Doesn't mean that they were able to eat normally during the 7 years, but they were able to survive. So maybe it didn't come up quite that high. But if you wanted those 7 years to follow to be normal, then those good years had to be 5 times the normal production of a normal year of production in Egypt.
And they were selling to everybody else.
Well, they were selling some to everybody else too. So maybe even more than 5 times. Or they weren't able to eat quite at normal levels, but they were able to survive. So there's some assumptions built into these numbers. But I think we're at the bottom of the assumption. Like, it could only go up from, they could go down a little bit if they didn't, but they're selling to people. That's a good point. So I always kind of wondered. And then this is just for fun, right? I always kind of wondered, why the people of Egypt all of a sudden were willing to give 20% of their produce, and then you don't hear anything about, I mean, obviously they could have done it by the sword, but I think this maybe is because they were like, dude, I normally make $50,000 a year, but I'm making $250,000 now. You want 50? Sure, I can afford 50. I'm sure everybody wouldn't like that, but still, it's interesting. 5 times, you know what I'm saying? I'm just giving you some round numbers there. That's like going from a $50,000 a year to $250,000 a year job if they have 5 times the amount of production.
If they're all of a sudden getting this sudden huge ingrowth, they don't have anywhere to store it, so it's going to rot anywhere.
Maybe.
Potentially.
Potentially. There's a lot of interesting things to think about.
It references the grain was like the sand of the sea.
Yeah.
So So it wasn't, it was like...
The money he collected.
Worthless.
The money he collected, yeah.
That was what he collected.
Yeah, so I did, like I made a graph here. You can graph it out.
Yeah.
And basically, normal, if normal is 1x, you know, and they go to 5x, they're still 3x above normal, even if they give 20% to the government. So,
but what I'm pushing at is, because there was such an abundance, the value dropped to nothing.
Well, that's true.
The value of corn dropped to nothing. So for them to give 20% was more him saying, well, let me have 20%. They're like, you can have as much as you want.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Economics of the thing is like,
sure. I mean, like I said, we're not told about all this, but
yeah,
it is interesting that there had to be a whole bunch more than normal for there to be able to collect enough for 7 years and feed everybody in the nation and the people coming in from the world as well.
And that just sounds not against you, but I don't know how to say this in such a way so that it's really demonstrating how massive God was giving this grain to the Egyptians, in the sense that when you say it was a lot, like, you don't know. No, I can't express what a lot is.
Yeah, that's why I was like, it'd be like going from 50 grand a year to 250 grand a year. That's just a 5x. It could have been beyond that.
Most of us can figure out what to do with five times what we make. But what about 50 billion?
Oh yeah,
we would have trouble spending it.
People that make that much money they have a hard time giving it away. They have so much.
You add enough zeros and it becomes inconceivable.
Yeah. You're way past what you need. You're way past what you could even, most people can't, that are up like that, they can't even figure out ways to spend it all.
The fact that you're storing 20% probably puts a little bit of an upper limit on what happened.
Yeah, I think probably.
Because you got
collecting. They're collecting 20%. I mean, that's the plan. Go out.
They stored it all.
Yeah, that's what Joseph's going to recommend. That's what I was going to read in a minute, but it's only three more verses that we're going to go to. That's what he's going to recommend. He recommends collect 20%. But the implication is that 20% will get you through 7 years. So, when they do it, I'm not going to go there. But when they do hit those 7 years, assumption is that production goes to zero. And it goes to zero not just in Egypt, but like beyond Egypt even. So at least it did in Canaan. I mean, we know that. I mean, we don't know about the rest of the world. But obviously not the rest of the world, but anyway.
The human nature element here, it lasted long enough that people quit saving much. Now, there's some assumption like it was after the first year they ran out of savings. Everybody came to Joseph.
I don't know. It's a lot of factors to figure out. But I just thought it was interesting that great plenty in verse 29, and the cows looked like it was more than they needed, which it's like part of the interpretation, right? I mean, God's telling Joseph what to tell Pharaoh. There will be great plenty. Whether he looked at those cows, and because he was a herdsman, he knew, well, it must have been great plenty because they would not look this way unless there was like super abundance for them to eat, which is really true, turns out. Which is what I wanted to share with you, is that's really true. All right. 5x at minimum, seems like. So, 33-36. Now, therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. Let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through famine. So we do see here that the promise is it won't perish, not that it'll like be normal necessarily. Also, you know, if they had extra, they very well could have sold it to other lands during the plentiful years. Maybe they sold it and didn't save any. And it turns out, we're going to find out later, that they had to use all that wealth to buy from Pharaoh what they needed to eat. So some spoilers there, but he says, you know, hey, you need to do this, but you need a wise man to do this. And that's where we're going to stop this time. But I wanted to just go over some things, some verses that are key verses that we speak to about humility. We see humility here in Joseph. And Joseph is willing to say, it's not me that can interpret these dreams. Proverbs 11:2 says, when pride comes, then comes disgrace. But with humbleness is wisdom. Proverbs 15:33, the fear of the Lord is instruction and wisdom, and humility comes before honor. And this actually ends up linking up wisdom and humility together. Proverbs 3:7, be not wise in your own eyes, fear the Lord, and turn away from evil. Being wise in your own eyes is a way of saying that you're being prideful and not humble. Proverbs 22:4, the reward for humility and the fear of the Lord is riches and honor and life. And we see this going to happen to Joseph, as he's going to be rewarded for it. His humility, in a sense, his humility is going to be part of what God uses to bring him to a point of great rewards. Proverbs 18:12, before destruction, a man's heart is haughty, but humility comes before honor. In the New Testament, James mirrors or echoes many of these verses. He's in James 3:13, who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. So it is important. It is part of the spiritual blessing and gifts of God to have humility, because without God, without his Spirit's influence in our lives, we are all prideful. So humility comes from God, and he's given it to us. It is also part of how God produces wisdom in our life, how he manufactures that, because the prideful man is unlikely to be also a wise man. Lastly, as I mentioned, this is a great example of the sovereignty of God. God, in this case, God is about to do something. God gives the answer for what he's about to do. And ultimately, where this is going to be used by God in his sovereignty to provide escape for his people as well. And so, and as you live your life and you think about and you maybe plan for the future, which God says is a good thing to do, planning for the future, we hold those plans lightly because God is the one who directs it. We plan, but God directs our steps. And as we plan the future, we can do so in hope because God has it under his control. And we can do so with peace, but only if we acknowledge his sovereignty over it.